This is Audible.
Bantam Doubleday Dell Audio Publishing presents The Lawnmower Man and Other Stories from Night Shift by Stephen King. The Lawnmower Man. In previous years, Harold Parkett had always taken pride in his lawn. He had owned a large silver lawn boy and paid the boy down the block $5 per cutting to push it. In those days, Harold Parkett had followed the Boston Red Sox on the radio with a beer in his hand and the knowledge that God was in his heaven and all was right with the world, including his lawn. But last year, in mid-October, fate had played Harold Parkett a nasty trick. While the boy was mowing the grass for the last time of the season, the Kastenmeier's dog had chased the Smith's cat under the mower. Harold's daughter had thrown up half a quart of cherry Kool-Aid into the lap of her new jumper, and his wife had nightmares for a week afterward. Although she had arrived after the fact, she had arrived in time to see Harold and the green-faced boy cleaning the blades. Their daughter and Mrs. Smith stood over them, weeping, although Alicia had taken time enough to change her jumper for a pair of blue jeans and one of those disgusting skimpy sweaters. She had a crush on the boy who mowed the lawn. After a week of listening to his wife moan and gobble in the next bed, Harold decided to get rid of the mower. He didn't really need a mower anyway, he supposed. He had hired a boy this year. Next year he would just hire a boy and a mower. And maybe Carla would stop moaning in her sleep. He might even get laid again. So he took the silver lawn boy down to Phil's Sunoco, and he and Phil dickered over it. Harold came away with a brand new Kelly Blackwall tire and a tank full of high test, and Phil put the silver lawn boy out on one of the pump islands with a hand-lettered for sale sign on it. And this year, Harold just kept putting off the necessary hiring. When he finally got around to calling last year's boy, his mother told him Frank had gone to the state university. Harold shook his head in wonder and went to the refrigerator to get a beer. Time certainly flew, didn't it? My God, yes. He put off hiring a new boy as first May, and then June slipped past him, and the Red Sox continued to wallow in fourth place. He sat on the back porch on the weekends and watched glumly as a never-ending progression of young boys he had never seen before popped out to mutter a quick hello before taking his buxom daughter off to the local passion pit. And the grass thrived and grew in a marvelous way. It was a good summer for grass, 3 days of shine followed by one of gentle rain, almost like clockwork. By mid-July, the lawn looked more like a meadow than a suburbanite's backyard, and Jack Kastenmeier had begun to make all sorts of extremely unfunny jokes, most of which concerned the price of hay and alfalfa. And Don Smith's 4-year-old daughter Jenny had taken to hiding in it when there was oatmeal for breakfast or a spinach for supper. One day in late July, Harold went out on the patio during the seventh-inning stretch and saw a woodchuck sitting perkily on the overgrown back walk. The time had come, he decided. He flicked off the radio, picked up the paper, and turned to the classifieds. And halfway down the part-time column, he found this. Lawns mowed, reasonable, 776-2390. Harold called the number, expecting a vacuuming housewife who would yell outside for her son. Instead, a briskly professional voice said, "Pastoral Greenery and Outdoor Services, how may we help you?" Cautiously, Harold told the voice how Pastoral Greenery could help him. Had it come to this, then? Were lawn cutters starting their own businesses and hiring office help? He asked the voice about rates, and the voice quoted him a reasonable figure. Harold hung up with a lingering feeling of unease and went back to the porch. He sat down, turned on the radio, and stared out over his glandular lawn at the Saturday clouds moving slowly across the Saturday sky. Carla and Alicia were at his mother-in-law's, and the house was his. It would be a pleasant surprise for them if the boy who was coming to cut the lawn finished before they came back. He cracked a beer and sighed as Dick Drago was touched for a double and then hit a batter. A little breeze shuffled across the screened-in porch. Crickets hummed softly in the long grass. Harold grunted something unkind about Dick Drago and then dozed off. He was jarred awake a half hour later by the doorbell. He knocked over his beer, getting up to answer it. A man in grass-stained denim overalls stood on the front stoop, chewing a toothpick. He was fat. The curve of his belly pushed his faded blue overall out to a point where Harold half suspected he had swallowed a basketball. Yes? Harold Parkett asked, still half asleep. The man grinned, rolled his toothpick from one corner of his mouth to the other, tugged at the seat of his overalls, and then pushed his green baseball cap up a notch on his forehead. There was a smear of fresh engine oil on the bill of his cap. And there he was, smelling of grass, earth, and oil, grinning at Harold Parkett. "Pastoral sent me, buddy," he said jovially, scratching his crotch. "You called, right? Right, buddy?" He grinned on endlessly. "Oh, the lawn. You?" Harold stared stupidly. "Yep, me." The lawnmower man bellowed fresh laughter into Harold's sleep-puffy face. Harold stood helplessly aside, and the lawnmower man tromped ahead of him down the hall, through the living room and kitchen, and onto the back porch. Now Harold had placed the man, and everything was all right. He had seen the type before, working for the sanitation department and the highway repair crews out on the turnpike. Always with a spare minute to lean on their shovels and smoke Lucky Strikes or Camels, looking at you as if they were the salt of the earth, able to hit you for five or sleep with your wife any time they wanted to. Harold had always been slightly afraid of men like this. They were always tan, dark brown, there were always nets of wrinkles around their eyes, and they always knew what to do. The back lawn's the real chore, he told the man, unconsciously deepening his voice. It's square, and there are no obstructions, but it's pretty well grown up. His voice faltered back into its normal register, and he found himself apologizing. I'm afraid I've let it go. No sweat, buddy, no strain. Great, great, great. The lawnmower man grinned at him with a thousand traveling salesman jokes in his eyes. The taller the better. Healthy soil, that's what you got there, by Circe. That's what I always say. By Circe? The lawnmower man cocked his head at the radio. Yastrzemski had just struck out. Red Sox fan? I'm a Yankees fan myself. He clumped back into the house and down the front hall. Harold watched him bitterly. He sat back down and looked accusingly for a moment at the puddle of beer under the table with the overturned Coors can in the middle of it. He thought of getting the mop from the kitchen and decided it would keep. No sweat. No strain. He opened his paper to the financial section and cast a judicious eye at the closing stock quotations. As a good Republican, he considered the Wall Street executives behind the column type to be at least minor demigods. By Circe. And he had wished many times that he could better understand the word as handed down from the mount, not on stone tablets, but in such enigmatic abbreviations as PCT and KDK and 3.28 up two-thirds. He had once bought a judicious 3 shares in a company called Midwest Bison Burgers, Inc., that had gone broke in 1968. He had lost his entire $75 investment. Now, he understood, Bison Burgers were quite the coming thing, the wave of the future. He had discussed this often with Sonny, the bartender down at the Goldfish Bowl. Sonny told Harold his trouble was that he was 5 years ahead of his time, and he should... A sudden racketing roar startled him out of the new doze he had just been slipping into. Harold jumped to his feet, knocking his chair over and staring around wildly. "That's a lawnmower?" Harold Parkett asked the kitchen. "My God, that's a lawnmower?" He rushed through the house and stared out the front door. There was nothing out there but a battered green van with the words Pastoral Greenery, Inc. painted on the side. The roaring sound was in back now. Harold rushed through his house again, burst onto the back porch, and stood frozen. It was obscene. It was a travesty. The aged red power mower the fat man had brought in his van was running on its own. No one was pushing it. In fact, no one was within 5 feet of it. It was running at a fever pitch, tearing through the unfortunate grass of Harold Parkett's back lawn like an avenging red devil straight from hell. It screamed and bellowed and farted oily blue smoke in a crazed kind of mechanical madness that made Harold feel ill with terror. The overripe smell of cut grass hung in the air like sour wine. But the lawnmower man was the true obscenity. The lawnmower man had removed his clothes, every stitch. They were folded neatly in the empty birdbath that was at the center of the back lawn. Naked and grass-stained, he was crawling along about 5 feet behind the mower, eating the cut grass. Green juice ran down his chin and dripped onto his pendulous belly. And every time the lawnmower whirled around a corner, he rose and did an odd skipping jump before prostrating himself again. "Stop!" Harold Parkett screamed. "Stop that!" But the lawnmower man took no notice, and his screaming scarlet familiar never slowed. If anything, it seemed to speed up. Its nicked steel grill seemed to grin sweatily at Harold as it raved by. Then Harold saw the mole. It must have been hiding in stunned terror just ahead of the mower in the swath of grass about to be slaughtered. It bolted across the cut band of lawn towards safety under the porch, a panicky brown streak. The lawnmower swerved, blatting and howling. It roared over the mole and spat it out in a string of fur and entrails that reminded Harold of the Smith's cat. The mole destroyed, the lawnmower rushed back to the main job. The lawnmower man crawled rapidly by, eating grass. Harold stood paralyzed with horror, stocks, bonds, and Weissenbergers completely forgotten. He could actually see that huge, pendulous belly expanding. The lawnmower man swerved and ate the mole. That was when Harold Parkett leaned out the screen door and vomited into the zinnias. The world went gray, and suddenly he realized he was fainting. Had fainted. He collapsed backward onto the porch and closed his eyes. Someone was shaking him. Carla was shaking him. He hadn't done the dishes or emptied the garbage, and Carla was going to be very angry, but that was all right. As long as she was waking him up, taking him out of the horrible dream he had been having, back into the normal world, nice, normal, Carla with her Playtex living girdle and her buck teeth. Buck teeth, yes, but not Carla's buck teeth. Carla had weak-looking chipmunk buck teeth, but these teeth were hairy. Green hair was growing on these buck teeth. It almost looked like grass. "Oh my God," Harold said.
"You fainted, buddy. Right? Huh?"
The lawnmower man was bending over him, grinning with his hairy teeth. His lips and chin were hairy, too. Everything was hairy and green. The yard stank of grass and gas and too sudden silence. Harold bolted up to a sitting position and stared at the dead mower. All the grass had been neatly cut, and there would be no need to rake this job, Harold observed sickly. If the lawnmower man had missed a single cut blade, he couldn't see it. He squinted obliquely at the lawnmower man and winced. He was still naked, still fat, still terrifying. Green trickles ran from the corners of his mouth.
"What is this?" Harold begged.
The man waved an arm benignly at the lawn.
"This? Well, it's a new thing the boss has been trying. It works out real good. Real good, buddy. We're killing two birds with one stone. We keep getting along toward the final stage, and we're making money to support our other operations to boot. See what I mean? Of course, every now and then we run into a customer who doesn't understand. Some people got no respect for efficiency, right? But the boss is always agreeable to a sacrifice. Sort of keeps the wheels greased, if you catch me."
Harold said nothing. One word knelled over and over in his mind, and that word was sacrifice. In his mind's eye, he saw the mole spewing out from under the battered red mower. He got up slowly like a palsied old man.
"Of course,"
he said, and could only come up with the line from one of Alicia's folk rock records. God bless the grass. The lawnmower man slapped one summer apple-colored thigh.
That's pretty good, buddy. In fact, that's damned good. I can see you got the right spirit. Okay if I write that down when I get back to the office? Might mean a promotion.
Certainly, Harold said, retreating toward the back door and striving to keep his melting smile in place.
You go right ahead and finish. I think I'll take a little nap. Sure, buddy, the lawnmower man said, getting ponderously to his feet.
Harold noticed the unusually deep split between the first and second toes, almost as if the feet were, well, cloven.
It hits everybody kind of hard at first, the lawnmower man said. You'll get used to it.
He eyed Harold's portly figure shrewdly.
In fact, you might even want to give it a whirl yourself. The boss has always got an eye out for new talent.
The boss, Harold repeated faintly. The lawnmower man paused at the bottom of the steps and gazed tolerantly up at Harold Parkett.
Well, say, buddy, I figured you must have guessed. God bless the grass and all.
Harold shook his head carefully, and the lawnmower man laughed.
Pan! Pan's the boss!
And he did a half-hop, half-shuffle in the newly cut grass, and the lawnmower screamed into life and began to trundle around the house.
The neighbors,
Harold began, but the lawnmower man only waved cheerily and disappeared. Out front, the lawnmower blatted and howled. Harold Parkett refused to look, as if by refusing he could deny the grotesque spectacle that the Kastenmeyers and Smiths, wretched Democrats both, were probably drinking in with horrified, but no doubt righteously, I-told-you-so eyes. Instead of looking, Harold went to the telephone, snatched it up, and dialed police headquarters from the emergency decal pasted on the phone's handset.
Sergeant Hall, the voice at the other end said.
Harold stuck a finger in his free ear and said, My name is Harold Parkett. My address is 1421 East Endicott Street. I'd like to report...
What?
What would he like to report? A man is in the process of raping and murdering my lawn, and he works for a fellow named Pan and has cloven feet?
Yes, Mr. Parkett?
Inspiration struck.
I'd like to report a case of indecent exposure.
Indecent exposure, Sergeant Hall repeated.
Yes, there's a man mowing my lawn. He's in the, altogether.
You mean he's naked? Sergeant Hall asked, politely incredulous.
Naked, Harold agreed, holding tightly to the frayed ends of his sanity.
Nude. Unclothed, bare-assed, on my front lawn. Now, will you get somebody the hell over here? That address was 1421 West Endicott, Sergeant Hall asked bemusedly.
East, Harold yelled, for God's sake.
And you say he's definitely naked. You are able to observe his, genitals and so on.
Harold tried to speak and could only gargle. The sound of the insane lawnmower seemed to be growing louder and louder, drowning out everything in the universe. He felt his gorge rise.
Can you speak up? Sergeant Hall buzzed. There's an awfully noisy connection there at your end.
The front door crashed open. Harold looked around and saw the lawnmower man's mechanized familiar advancing through the door. Behind it came the lawnmower man himself, still quite naked. With something approaching true insanity, Harold saw the man's pubic hair was a rich, fertile green. He was twirling his baseball cap on one finger.
That was a mistake, buddy, the lawnmower man said reproachfully. You should have stuck with God bless the grass. Hello? Hello, Mr. Parkett?
The telephone dropped from Harold's nerveless fingers as the lawnmower began to advance on him, cutting through the nap of Carla's new mohawk rug and spitting out brown hunks of fiber as it came.
Harold stared at it with a kind of bird and snake fascination until it reached the coffee table. When the mower shunted it aside, shearing one leg into sawdust and splinters as it did so, he climbed over the back of his chair and began to retreat toward the kitchen, dragging the chair in front of him.
"That won't do any good, buddy,"
the lawnmower man said kindly.
"Apt to be messy, too. Now, if you was just to show me where you keep your sharpest butcher knife, we could get this sacrifice business out of the way real painless. I think the bird bath would do, and then..."
Harold shoved the chair at the lawnmower, which had been craftily flanking him while the naked man drew his attention and bolted through the doorway. The lawnmower roared around the chair, jetting out exhaust, and as Harold smashed open the porch screen door and leaped down the steps, he heard it, smelled it, felt it, right at his heels. The lawnmower roared off the top step like a skier going off a jump. Harold sprinted across his newly cut back lawn, but there had been too many beers, too many afternoon naps. He could sense it nearing him, then on his heels, and then he looked over his shoulder and tripped over his own feet. The last thing Harold Parquette saw was the grinning grill of the charging lawnmower, rocking back to reveal its flashing green-stained blades, and above it the fat face of the lawnmower man, shaking his head in good-natured reproof.
"Hell of a thing," Lieutenant Goodwin said as the last of the photographs were taken. He nodded to the two men in white, and they trundled their basket across the lawn. He reported some naked guy on his lawn not 2 hours ago.
"Is that so?" Patrolman Cooley asked.
"Yeah, one of the neighbors called in, too, a guy named Kastenmeier. He thought it was Parquette himself, but..." "Maybe it was, Cooley. Maybe it was."
"Sir?"
"Crazy with the heat," Lieutenant Goodwin said gravely and tapped his temple. "Schizo-fucking-phrenia."
Yes, sir, Cooley said respectfully.
"Where's the rest of him?"
one of the white coats asked.
"The birdbath," Goodwin said. He looked profoundly up at the sky.
"Did you say the bird bath?" the white coat asked.
"Indeed I did," Lieutenant Goodwin agreed.
Patrolman Cooley looked at the bird bath and suddenly lost most of his tan.
"Sex maniac," Lieutenant Goodwin said. "Must have been."
"Prints?"
Cooley asked thickly. "You might as well ask for footprints," Goodwin said.
He gestured at the newly cut grass. Patrolman Cooley made a strangled noise in his throat. Lieutenant Goodwin stuffed his hands into his pockets and rocked back on his heels.
"The world," he said gravely, "is full of nuts. Never forget that, Cooley. Schizos. Lab boys say somebody chased Parquette through his own living room with a lawnmower. Can you imagine that?"
"No, sir," Cooley said. Goodwin looked out over Harold Parquette's neatly manicured lawn.
"Well, like the man said when he saw the black-haired Swede, it surely is a Norse of a different color."
Goodwin strolled around the house and Cooley followed him. Behind them, the scent of newly mown grass hung pleasantly in the air.
Sometimes they come back. Jim Norman's wife had been waiting for him since 2, and when she saw the car pull up in front of their apartment building, she came out to meet him. She had gone to the store and bought a celebration meal, a couple of steaks, a bottle of Lancers, a head of lettuce, and Thousand Island dressing. Now, watching him get out of the car, she found herself hoping with some desperation, and not for the first time that day, that there was going to be something to celebrate. He came up the walk, holding his new briefcase in one hand and four texts in the other. She could see the title of the top one, Introduction to Grammar. She put her hands on his shoulder and asked, "How did it go?" And he smiled.
But that night, he had the old dream for the first time in a very long time and woke up sweating with a scream behind his lips. His interview had been conducted by the principal of Harold Davis High School and the head of the English department. The subject of his breakdown had come up. He had expected it would. The principal, a tall and cadaverous man named Fenton, had leaned back and looked at the ceiling. Simmons, the English head, lit his pipe. "I was under a great deal of pressure at the time," Jim Norman said. His fingers wanted to twist about in his lap, but he wouldn't let them.
"I think we understand that," Fenton said, smiling, "and while we have no desire to pry, I'm sure we'd all agree that teaching is a pressure occupation, especially at the high school level. You're on stage 5 periods out of 7, and you're playing to the toughest audience in the world. That's why," he finished with some pride, "teachers have more ulcers than any other professional group, with the exception of air traffic controllers."
Jim said, "The pressures involved in my breakdown were extreme." Fenton and Simmons nodded noncommittal encouragement, and Simmons clicked his lighter open to rekindle his pipe. Suddenly the office seemed very tight, very close. Jim had the queer sensation that someone had just turned on a heat lamp over the back of his neck. His fingers were twisting in his lap, and he made them stop. "I was in my senior year and practice teaching. My mother had died the summer before, cancer, and in my last conversation with her, she asked me to go right on and finish. My brother, my older brother, died when we were both quite young. He had been planning to teach, and she thought..." He could see from their eyes that he was wandering and thought, "God, I'm making a botch of this." "I did as she asked," he said, leaving the tangled relationship of his mother and brother, Wayne, poor murdered Wayne, and himself behind. "During the second week of my intern teaching, my fiancé was involved in a hit-and-run accident. She was the hit part of it. Some kid in a hot rod. They never called him." Simmons made a soft noise of encouragement. "I went on. There didn't seem to be any other course. She was in a great deal of pain, a badly broken leg and 4 fractured ribs, but no danger. I don't think I really knew the pressure I was under." "Careful now, this is where the ground slopes away." "I interned at Center Street Vocational Trades High," Jim said.
"Garden spot of the city," Fenton said. "Switchblades, motorcycle boots, zip guns in the lockers, lunch money protection rackets, and every third kid selling dope to the other two. I know about trades."
"There was a kid named Mac Zimmerman," Jim said. "Sensitive boy, played the guitar. I had him in a composition class, and he had talent. I came in one morning, and 2 boys were holding him while a third smashed his Yamaha guitar against the radiator. Zimmerman was screaming. I yelled for them to stop and give me the guitar. I started for them, and someone slugged me." Jim shrugged. "That was it. I had a breakdown. No screaming memes or crouching in the corner. I just couldn't go back. When I got near trades, my chest would tighten up. I couldn't breathe right. I got cold sweat."
"That happens to me, too," Fenton said amiably.
"I went into analysis, a community therapy deal. I couldn't afford a psychiatrist. It did me good. Sally and I are married. She has a slight limp and a scar, but otherwise good as new." He looked at them squarely.
"I guess you could say the same for me."
Fenton said,
"You actually finished your practice teaching requirement at Cortez High School, I believe." "That's no bed of roses either," Simmons said.
"I wanted a hard school," Jim said. "I swapped with another guy to get Cortez."
"A's from your supervisor and critic teacher," Fenton commented.
"Yes."
"And a 4-year average of 3.88,
Damn close to straight A's.
I enjoyed my college work. Fenton and Simmons glanced at each other, then stood up. Jim got up.
We'll be in touch, Mr. Norman, Fenton said. We do have a few more applicants to interview.
Yes, of course.
But speaking for myself, I'm impressed by your academic records and personal candor.
It's nice of you to say so.
Sim, perhaps Mr. Norman would like a coffee before he goes.
They shook hands. In the hall, Simmons said,
I think you've got the job if you want it. That's off the record, of course.
Jim nodded. He had left a lot off the record himself. Davis High was a forbidding rock pile that housed a remarkably modern plant. The science wing alone had been funded at $1.5 million in last year's budget. The classrooms, which still held the ghosts of the WPA workers who had built them and the post-war kids who had first used them, were furnished with modern desks and soft-glare blackboards. The students were clean, well-dressed, vivacious, affluent. 6 out of 10 seniors owned their own cars. All in all, a good school. A fine school to teach in during the sicky 70s. It made Center Street vocational trades look like darkest Africa. But after the kids were gone, something old and brooding seemed to settle over the halls and whisper in the empty rooms. Some black, noxious beast, never quite in view. Sometimes, as he walked down the Wing 4 corridor toward the parking lot with his new briefcase in one hand, Jim Norman thought he could almost hear it breathing. He had the dream again near the end of October, and that time he did scream. He clawed his way into waking reality to find Sally sitting up in bed beside him, holding his shoulder. His heart was thudding heavily.
God, he said, and scrubbed a hand across his face.
Are you all right?
Sure. I yelled, didn't I?
Boy, did you. Nightmare?
Yes.
Something from when those boys broke that fella's guitar?
No, he said. Much older than that. Sometimes it comes back, that's all. No sweat.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Do you want a glass of milk? Her eyes were dark with concern. He kissed her shoulder.
No.
Go to sleep. She turned off the light and he lay there, looking into the darkness.
He had a good schedule for the new teacher on the staff. Period one was free. 2 and 3 were freshman comp, one group dull, one kind of fun. Period four was his best class, American lit with college-bound seniors who got a kick out of bashing the old masters around for a period each day. Period five was a consultation period when he was supposed to see students with personal or academic problems. There were very few who seemed to have either or who wanted to discuss them with him, and he spent most of those periods with a good novel. Period 6 was a grammar course, dry as chalk dust. Period 7 was his only cross. The class was called Living with Literature, and it was held in a small box of a classroom on the 3rd floor. The room was hot in the early fall and cold as the winter approached. The class itself was an elective for what school catalogs coyly called the slow learner. There were 27 slow learners in Jim's class, most of them school jocks. The kindest thing you could accuse them of would be disinterest, and some of them had a streak of outright malevolence. He walked in one day to find an obscene and cruelly accurate caricature of himself on the board, with Mr. Norman unnecessarily chalked under it. He wiped it off without comment and proceeded with the lesson in spite of the snickers. He worked up interesting lesson plans, included AV materials, and ordered several high-interest, high-comprehension texts, all to no avail. The classroom mood veered between unruly hilarity and sullen silence. Early in November, a fight broke out between 2 boys during a discussion of mice and men. Jim broke it up and sent both boys to the office. When he opened his book to where he had left off, the words, "Bite it," glared up at him. He took the problem to Simmons, who shrugged and lit his pipe.
I don't have any real solution, Jim. Last period is always a bitch, and for some of them, a D grade in your class means no more football or basketball, and they've had the other gut English courses, so they're stuck with it.
And me too, Jim said glumly. Simmons nodded.
Show them you mean business, and they'll buckle down, if only to keep their sports eligibility.
But Period 7 remained a constant thorn in his side. One of the biggest problems in living with Lit was a huge, slow-moving moose named Chip Osway. In early December, during the brief hiatus between football and basketball, Osway played both, Jim caught him with a crib sheet and ran him out of the classroom.
If you flunk me, we'll get you, you son of a bitch, Osway yelled down the dim third-floor corridor. You hear me?
Go on, Jim said. Don't waste your breath.
We'll get you, creepo.
Jim went back into the classroom. They looked up at him, blandly, faces betraying nothing. He felt a surge of unreality, like the feeling that had washed over him before. Before. We'll get you, creepo. He took his gradebook out of his desk, opened it to the page titled Living with Literature, and carefully lettered an F in the exam slot next to Chip Osway's name. That night, he had the dream again. The dream was always cruelly slow. There was time to see and feel everything, and there was the added horror of reliving events that were moving toward a known conclusion, as helpless as a man strapped into a car going over a cliff. In the dream, he was 9, and his brother Wayne was 12. They were going down Broad Street in Stratford, Connecticut, bound for the Stratford Library. Jim's books were 2 days overdue, and he had hooked 4 cents from the cupboard bowl to pay the fine. It was summer vacation. You could smell the freshly cut grass. You could hear a ball game floating out of some second-floor apartment window. Yankees leading the Red Sox 6-0 in the top of the 8th. Ted Williams batting. And you could see the shadows from the Burritt's Building Company slowly lengthening across the street as the evening turned slowly toward dark. Beyond Teddy's Market and Burritt's, there was a railroad overpass, and on the other side, a number of the local losers hung around a closed gas station, 5 or 6 boys in leather jackets and peg jeans. Jim hated to go by them. They yelled out, "Hey, Four Eyes," and "Hey, Shit Heels," and "Hey, you got an extra quarter," and once they chased them half a block. But Wayne would not take the long way around. That would be chicken. In the dream, the overpass loomed closer and closer, and you began to feel dread struggling in your throat like a big black bird. You saw everything. The Burritt's neon sign just starting to stutter on and off. The flakes of rust on the green overpass. The glitter of broken glass in the cinders of the railroad bed. A broken bike rim in the gutter. You try to tell Wayne you've been through this before 100 times. The local losers aren't hanging around the gas station this time. They're hidden in the shadows under the trestle, but it won't come out. You're helpless. Then you're underneath, and some of the shadows detach themselves from the walls, and a tall kid with a blonde crew cut and a broken nose pushes Wayne up against the sooty cinder blocks and says, "Give us some money. Let me alone." You try to run, but a fat guy with greasy black hair grabs you and throws you against the wall next to your brother. His left eyelid is jittering up and down nervously, and he says, "Come on, kid. How much you got? 4 cents? You fucking liar." Wayne tries to twist free, and a guy with odd orange-colored hair helps the blonde one to hold him. The guy with the jittery eyelid suddenly bashes you one in the mouth. You feel a sudden heaviness in your groin, and a dark patch appears on your jeans. "Look, Vinny, he wet himself." Wayne's struggles become frenzied, and he almost, not quite, gets free. Another guy
wearing black chinos and a white t-shirt, throws him back. There is a small strawberry birthmark on his chin. The stone throat of the overpass is beginning to tremble. The metal girders pick up a thrumming vibration. Train coming. Someone strikes the books out of your hands, and the kid with the birthmark on his chin kicks them into the gutter. Wayne suddenly kicks out with his right foot, and it connects with the crotch of the kid with the jittery face. He screams,
"Vinny, he's getting away!"
The kid with the jittery face is screaming about his nuts, but even his howls are lost in the gathering, shaking roar of the approaching train. Then it is over them, and its noise fills the world. Light flashes on switchblades. The kid with the blonde crew cut is holding one, and Birthmark has the other. You can't hear Wayne, but his words are in the shape of his lips. "Run, Jimmy, run!" You slip to your knees, and the hands holding you are gone, and you skitter between a pair of legs like a frog. A hand slaps down on your back, groping for purchase, and gets none. Then you are running back the way you came with all of the horrible, sludgy slowness of dreams. You look back over your shoulder and see... He woke in the dark, Sally sleeping peacefully beside him. He bit back the scream, and when it was throttled, he fell back. When he had looked back into the yawning darkness of the overpass, he had seen the blonde kid and the birthmark kid drive their knives into his brother. Blondie's below the breastbone, and birthmark's directly into his brother's groin. He lay in the darkness, breathing harshly, waiting for that 9-year-old ghost to depart, waiting for honest sleep to blot it all away. An unknown time later, it did. The Christmas vacation and semester break were combined in the city school district, and the holiday was almost a month long. The dream came twice early on and did not come again. He and Sally went to visit her sister in Vermont and skied a great deal. They were happy. Jim's living with lit problems seemed inconsequential and a little foolish in the open crystal air. He went back to school with a winter tan, feeling cool and collected. Simmons called him on the way to his Period 2 class and handed him a folder.
New student, Period 7. Name is Robert Lawson. Transfer.
Hey, I've got 27 in there right now, Sim. I'm overloaded.
You've still got 27. Bill Stearns got killed the Tuesday after Christmas. Car accident. Hit and run.
Billy? The picture formed in his mind in black and white like a senior photograph. William Stearns, Key Club 1, Football 1, 2, Penn and Lance 2. He had been one of the few good ones in Living with Lit. Quiet, consistent A's and B's on his exams. Didn't volunteer often, but usually summoned the correct answers. Laced with a pleasing dry wit when called on. Dead? 15 years old. His own mortality suddenly whispered through his bones like a cold draft under a door. Christ, that's awful. Do they know what happened?
Cops are checking into it. He was downtown exchanging a Christmas present. Started across Rampart Street and an old Ford sedan hit him. No one got the license number, but the words "Snake Eyes" were written on the side door, the way a kid would do it.
Christ, Jim said again.
There's the bell, Simmons said.
He hurried away, pausing to break up a crowd of kids around a drinking fountain. Jim went toward his class, feeling empty. During his free period, he flipped open Robert Lawson's folder. The first page was a green sheet from Milford High, which Jim had never heard of. The second was a student personality profile, adjusted IQ of 78. Some manual skills, not many. Antisocial answers to the Barnett-Hudson personality test. Poor aptitude scores. Jim thought sourly that he was a Living with Lit kid all the way. The next page was a disciplinary history, the yellow sheet.
The Milford sheet was white with a black border, and it was depressingly well-filled. Lawson had been in 100 kinds of trouble. He turned the next page, glanced down at a school photo of Robert Lawson, then looked again. Terror suddenly crept into the pit of his belly and coiled there, warm and hissing. Lawson was staring antagonistically into the camera as if posing for a police mugshot rather than a school photographer. There was a small strawberry birthmark on his chin. By period 7, he had brought all these civilized rationalizations into play. He told himself there must be thousands of kids with red birthmarks on their chins. He told himself that the hood who had stamped his brother that day 16 long dead years ago would now be at least 32. But climbing to the third floor, the apprehension remained. And another fear to go with it. This is how you felt when you were cracking up. He tasted the bright steel of panic in his mouth. The usual group of kids was horsing around the door of room 33, and some of them went in when they saw Jim coming. A few hung around, talking in undertones and grinning. He saw the new boy standing beside Chip Osway. Robert Lawson was wearing blue jeans and heavy yellow tractor boots, all the rage this year. "Chip, go on in.
That an order?"
He smiled vacuously over Jim's head. "Sure."
"You flunked me on that test?"
"Sure."
"Yeah, that's a..."
The rest was an under-the-breath mumble. Jim turned to Robert Lawson. "You're new," he said. "I just wanted to tell you how we run things around here."
"Sure, Mr. Norman."
His right eyebrow was split with a small scar, a scar Jim knew. There could be no mistake. It was crazy, it was lunacy, but it was also a fact. 16 years ago, this kid had driven a knife into his brother. Numbly, as if from a great distance, he heard himself beginning to outline the class rules and regulations. Robert Lawson hooked his thumbs into his garrison belt, listened, smiled, and began to nod as if they were old friends.
"Jim?
Hmm?
Is something wrong?"
"No."
"Those Living with Lit boys still giving you a hard time?"
No answer.
"Jim?"
No.
"Why don't you go to bed early tonight?"
But he didn't. The dream was very bad that night. When the kid with the strawberry birthmark stabbed his brother with his knife, he called after Jim.
"You next, kid. Right through the bag."
He woke up screaming. He was teaching Lord of the Flies that week and talking about symbolism when Lawson raised his hand.
"Robert," he said evenly, "why do you keep staring at me?"
Jim blinked and felt his mouth go dry.
"You see something green, or is my fly unzipped?"
A nervous titter from the class. Jim replied evenly, I wasn't staring at you, Mr. Lawson. Can you tell us why Ralph and Jack disagreed over..."
"You were staring at me."
"Do you want to talk about it with Mr. Fenton?" Lawson appeared to think it over.
"Nah."
"Good. Now, can you tell us why Ralph and Jack..."
"I didn't read it. I think it's a dumb book."
Jim smiled tightly. "Do you know? You want to remember that while you're judging the book is also judging you. Now, can anyone else tell me why they disagreed over the existence of the beast?" Kathy Slavin raised her hand timidly, and Lawson gave her a cynical once-over and said something to Chip Osway. The words leaving his lips looked like, "nice tits." Chip nodded.
"Kathy? Isn't it because, Jack wanted to hunt the beast?
Good.
He turned and began to write on the board. At the instant his back was turned, a grapefruit smashed against the board beside his head. He jerked backward and wheeled around. Some class members laughed, but Osway and Lawson only looked at Jim innocently. Jim stooped and picked up the grapefruit. Someone, he said, looking toward the back of the room, ought to have this jammed down his goddamn throat. Kathy Slavin gasped. He tossed the grapefruit in the wastebasket and turned back to the blackboard. He opened the morning paper, sipping his coffee, and saw the headline about halfway down.
God,
he said, splitting his wife's easy flow of morning chatter. His belly felt suddenly filled with splinters. Teenage girl falls to her death. Catherine Slavin, a 17-year-old junior at Harold Davis High School, either fell or was pushed from the roof of her downtown apartment house early yesterday evening. The girl, who kept a pigeon coop on the roof, had gone up with a sack of feed, according to her mother. Police said an unidentified woman in a neighboring development had seen three young boys running across the roof at 6:45 p.m., just minutes after the girl's body... Continued, page 3.
Jim? Was she one of yours?
But he could only look at her mutely. 2 weeks later, Simmons met him in the hall after the lunch bell with a folder in his hand, and Jim felt a terrible sinking in his belly. New student, he said flatly to Simmons. Living with Lit. Sims' eyebrows went up.
How did you know that?
Jim shrugged and held his hand out for the folder.
Gotta run, Simmons said. Department heads are meeting on course evaluations. You look a little run down. Feeling okay?
That's right. A little run down, like Billy Stearns.
Sure, he said. That's the stuff, Simmons said, and clapped him on the back.
When he was gone, Jim opened the folder to the picture, wincing in advance, like a man about to be hit. But the face wasn't instantly familiar. Just a kid's face. Maybe he'd seen it before, maybe not. The kid, David Garcia, was a hulking, dark-haired boy with rather negroid lips and dark, slumbering eyes. The yellow sheet said he was also from Milford High and that he had spent 2 years in Granville Reformatory. Car theft. Jim closed the folder with hands that trembled slightly. Sally? She looked up from her ironing. He had been staring at a TV basketball game without really seeing it. Nothing, he said. Forgot what I was going to say.
Must have been a lie.
He smiled mechanically and looked at the TV again. It had been on the tip of his tongue to spill everything, but how could he? It was worse than crazy. Where would you start? The dream? The breakdown? The appearance of Robert Lawson? No. With Wayne, your brother. But he had never told anyone about that, not even in analysis. His thoughts turned to David Garcia and the dreamy terror that had washed over him when they had looked at each other in the hall. Of course, he had only looked vaguely familiar in the picture. Pictures don't move or twitch. Garcia had been standing with Lawson and Chip Osway, and when he looked up and saw Jim Norman, he smiled and his eyelids began to jitter up and down. And voices spoke in Jim's mind with unearthly clarity.
Come on, kid. How much you got?
4 cents?
You fucking liar. Look, Vinny, he wet himself.
Jim? Did you say something?
No. But he wasn't sure if he had or not. He was getting very scared. One day after school in early February, there was a knock on the teacher's room door, and when Jim opened it, Chip Osway stood there. He looked frightened. Jim was alone. It was 4:10, and the last of the teachers had gone home an hour before. He was correcting a batch of American Lit themes.
Chip,
he said evenly. Chip shuffled his feet. Can, I talk to you for a minute, Mr. Norman?
Sure, but if it's about that test, you're wasting your...
It's not about that. Can I smoke in here? Go ahead. He lit his cigarette with a hand that trembled slightly. He didn't speak for perhaps as long as a minute. It seemed that he couldn't. His lips twitched. His hands came together and his eyes slitted, as if some inner self was struggling to find expression. He suddenly burst out. If they do it, I want you to know I wasn't in on it. I don't like those guys. They're creeps.
What guys, Chip?
Lawson and that Garcia creep.
Are they planning to get me?
The old dreamy terror was on him, and he knew the answer.
I liked them at first, Chip said. We went out and had a few beers. I started bitching about you and that test about how I was going to get you, but that was just talk. I swear it.
What happened?
They took me right up on it. Asked what time you left school, what kind of car you drove, all that stuff. I said, what do you got against him? And Garcia said they knew you a long time ago.
Hey, are you all right?
The cigarette, he said thickly. Haven't ever gotten used to the smoke.
Chip ground it out.
I asked them when they knew you, and Bob Lawson said I was still pissing my dieties then, but they're 17, the same as me.
Then what?
Well, Garcia leans over the table and says you can't want to get him very bad if you don't even know when he leaves the fucking school. What was you gonna do? So I says I was gonna matchstick your tires and leave you with four flats.
He looked at Jim with pleading eyes.
I wasn't even gonna do that. I said it because...
You were scared? Jim asked quietly.
Yeah, and I'm still scared.
What did they think of your idea?
Chip shuddered. Bob Lawson says, well, is that what you was gonna do, you cheap prick? And I said, trying to be tough, what was you gonna do? Off him? And Garcia, his eyelids started to go up and down. He takes something out of his pocket and clicked it open, and it's a switch knife. That's when I took off.
When was this, Chip?
Yesterday. I'm scared to sit with those guys now, Mr. Norman.
Okay, Jim said. Okay. He looked down at the papers he had been correcting without seeing them.
What are you going to do?
I don't know, Jim said. I really don't. On Monday morning, he still didn't know. His first thought had been to tell Sally everything, starting with his brother's murder 16 years ago, but it was impossible. She would be sympathetic, but frightened and unbelieving. Simmons? Also impossible. Simmons would think he was mad, and maybe he was. A man in a group encounter session he had attended had said having a breakdown was like breaking a vase and then gluing it back together. You could never trust yourself to handle that vase again with any surety. You couldn't put a flower in it because flowers need water, and water might dissolve the glue.
Am I crazy, then?
If he was, Chip Osway was, too. That thought came to him as he was getting into his car, and a bolt of excitement went through him. Of course. Lawson and Garcia had threatened him in Chip Osway's presence. That might not stand up in court, but it would get the two of them suspended if he could get Chip to repeat his story in Fenton's office.